It's time for the Scott Rintoul Show.
He holds, he shoots, he scores!
Where the West...
Pettersson up the left wing, steps into a slap shot and scores. Elias Pettersson, oh my word, again.
...is one.
Rebound, Kachuk scores! What a night for Matthew Kachuk.
Let's make it happen. Everything you've got, no excuses.
Jackson avoids, spins, he's in. Touchdown, McCaffrey leaps.
Now, here's Scott Rintoul.
Pull my trigger, let me blow your mind.
What's going on? How's your Thursday? Scott Rintoul with you. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. We're going to make your Thursday better. That's what we do. A little bit overcast, but shouldn't be too bad as far as the temperature goes in the lower mainland today. You should be able to get outside, get some fresh air, do the old healthy body, healthy mind thing to help you get through this day. And by listening to this show, we're going to help you through it as well. We are that necessary distraction for a lot of people, and we're happy to provide it. Thank you for joining us today. You can always get in on the conversation at 650-650, and I would love your thoughts on this first conversation we're about to have. We got a really good guest list coming your way today. We're going to have Rick Hansen on the show today as we celebrate Williams Lake and that sports culture and sports history from that part of our province. Carey Price, obviously, from there as well, unable to join the show today, but we will talk about him at some point during the course of the 11 o'clock hour on the Best of BC. Stephen Brunt at the bottom of this hour, Brendan Morrison at the bottom of the next. A lot to get into with them. And there is a part of me that doesn't want to start this show with a beef, but I'm going to anyway. I'm a generally positive person. I like to highlight positive things as opposed to negative ones. But we're going to start here anyway, because what's in the news right now? From hockey fans' perspective, from sports fans' perspective in this country, obviously the NHL format, the return-to-play plan that is out there right now. And there are many hurdles to get over, but people are genuinely excited about this. People are genuinely optimistic, even though they understand it comes with some sort of risk along the way that it may not, in fact, happen. Now, the job that I do, and many of you have said this to me before, and many of you aspire to do this job if you happen to be in the broadcast industry. You love what I do, not because it's me, but you just love the thought of talking sports all day. And that's why you like to interact with the show. 650, 650, you can find me on Twitter at Scott Rintoul. The chance I have to interact with you, it is supposed to be fun. And generally, it is. Most of the time, it's fun. Jamie and I, we put this show together every single day. Jamie Dodd, the producer of this program, and he'll chime in here during the course of our open today. And we always want to do three things for you. I don't think this is a real peek behind the curtain. I think this is fairly obvious. We try to entertain you, put a smile on your face at some point. We try to educate or inform you with some of our guests and some of the topics we bring up. And we want to interact with you as well. If we can do those three things every single day, we feel like we've had a great show. Not every topic is going to be a knee-slap and laugh track. Like one we're going to get to in a few minutes, by the way, and we'll touch on with Stephen Brunt at the bottom of this hour. But we want to enjoy the process as much as we hope that you do. So there's not a lot that agitates me. Jamie's a pretty easygoing guy. He doesn't get agitated very much either. We are talking about sports. We understand context. But one of the things that makes me bristle a little bit, given the job I do, is the term the media. Because generally when you hear the media, the context in which it is used is a negative connotation. There's a blanket statement that generally follows the media. Ah, the media is just trying to stir things up. The media's out to get people. The media only talks about bad stories, never good stories. It drives me in my profession nuts, the same way it probably drives good lawyers or good politicians nuts. Ah, all lawyers are crooks. All politicians are thieves. You hear that from a lot of people. It's an easy default. And in those professions, much like in mine, when you see someone doing their job poorly, your response is generally, hey, man, don't lump me in with a few people who don't do the job the right way. I think most fans out there, I think most listeners out there are smart enough to figure out who the people are that are in the job just to produce clickbait, and which people actually do quality journalism and create quality conversations. But I understand why it's a popular default for a lot of people. And in a lot of cases, that popular default permeates the ranks of professional athletes. And Maybe this is why I bristle. It makes the job a little more difficult to do if that is the attitude of your subject going into a conversation. They are conditioned, as professional athletes in many cases, to be on guard, to believe that their words are going to be twisted, that they are going to be taken out of context. And usually, I think that is overblown. That protectionist attitude, I don't think it gives enough credit to the subject involved, to the player who's going to have the conversation. I think it sometimes ends up hurting those players personally in terms of their brand. I think it sometimes hurts the sport. We talked about this with hockey a lot. Hey, let them have their personality. Don't be so guarded. Don't be so protectionist and say it's about the team. Don't say anything individual. And there are players within the game who feel the exact same way. They have said we need to get our personalities out there more. But there are times that I do sympathize with the athletes or the coaches or the managers. Case in point in the last 24 hours is Rod Brind'Amour. I've seen the headlines. They popped up on my phone yesterday. You've probably seen them as well if you're a hockey fan. And the headlines were something about Rod Brind'Amour having a beef with the NHL format. Hey, 68 games, we're just going to throw those out. Well, it didn't really give you the context of what Brind'Amour was saying and how he was saying it. He was on a podcast with a couple of friends of the show and of the station, Emily Kaplan, Greg Wyshynski, both of ESPN. They do a weekly podcast, and they had him on. And Wyshynski gave Brind'Amour a fairly leading question, which you can do, and athletes and coaches know how to handle that. Wyshynski basically teed it up on the heels of what Jordan Martinook had said earlier this week. Yeah, we didn't vote for the format because we didn't think it was really that fair and not a great matchup that we've drawn all of a sudden here in the New York Rangers. And so Wyshynski led into Brind'Amour saying, yeah, it almost feels, you know, like maybe a raw deal that you guys got. Here's what Brind'Amour had to say in the entire context of his answer.
First of all, you know, his comments are dead on. We want to play, and we understood that, you know, there might have been some teams, you know, whether 16 field, 18. I mean, you understood that. That wasn't really the issue. I think the bigger issue felt like, and especially our guys, was what was the 68 games we played for? Like, what did we grind for? Where are we, you know, that the bulk of the season was completed, and they just threw that out. And I think that's how they felt. And I think that's a little bit justifiable in a way. And, you know, why not carry the points over that you had? If we're playing in, I think that the thought was if you're playing in five, six, seven games, however, we could easily have all had the same amount of games, figured that out. That would have been your play-in, and then take your points with you and see how you end up. Would have probably been the way that I think the guys would have felt, you know, fair, I guess is the best way to put it. But we understand. Nobody really cares at the end of the day. You know, they want to see hockey. We want to get back to playing. Is it the best way to do it? Probably not, in my opinion, but I hope we can play. And, you know, once they get this format figured out, as far as not the format necessarily, but how we're going to do it, nobody's going to talk about this, you know, whether it's fair or not fair. It doesn't matter. We're moving on, and we're going to try to do our best.
So you hear that entire answer, and it's not really controversial, is it? Rod Brind'Amour, when he said the thing about the 68 games, what was he actually doing? He was outlining the attitudes of his players. He was paraphrasing the feelings his players had when they made the vote and why they made the vote. And what did he say? We, more than anything, want to get back to playing, and probably you weren't going to satisfy everybody. Is it the most fair way? Probably not, in my opinion, but okay, who cares? We're going to play. We're not really worried about it. Nobody else is going to be worried about it, so let's go. But all of a sudden, Rod Brind'Amour is painted as a guy who's griping about the league's format, and the Carolina Hurricanes are not happy about this. Let's talk about whether the Carolina Hurricanes are particularly aggrieved or not. That was the connotation of the headline. That was the clickbait that all of a sudden was out there. And so I understand that side of, you know what, maybe we shouldn't say anything. Brind'Amour is not that kind of guy. I think Brind'Amour is a guy who lets things roll off his back. And if anything, he'll use it as motivation. Part of what I thought he said yesterday was a way to get his players fired up. And I'll bet that's the way they take it in Carolina when they look at a New York Rangers team that was surging. And that there are people that will predict, even though I think it's a fruitless endeavor right now, man, you want to talk wide open. This format is so wide open. People are healthier than before. We have no idea what teams are going to look like, how much rust there's going to be, which goalies are going to be ready to go. Good luck predicting anything out of this. But Rod Brind'Amour will use this. They used it last year, and when you want a second run at this, you got to find a little different way to go about it. But I understand why athletes, why coaches, why organizations see something like that yesterday and they get a little bit disgruntled with it and they don't want to be involved in the process. Get in on the conversation, 650-650. It's why I'm going to give you Jim Benning's answer to the Judd Brackett situation in its entirety. I will give you the question that was asked yesterday as well. This has been on the front burner for a lot of Canucks fans, though maybe not for the Canucks, over the past month or so, maybe the past couple of months, depending on how much stock you put in, whether or not Judd Brackett remains with the situation. Jim Benning was on Reach Deep yesterday, exclusive interview here on your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650, and the guys needed to address the Judd Brackett situation because Canucks fans continued to talk about it. I'm sure it's not exactly what Jim Benning wanted to come on and talk about, and it certainly isn't the only thing he talked about. He talked about the format. He talked about his team. He talked about whether or not they were going to be better prepared or how this shaped up, and he talked about the fact that JT Miller deal and that trade was going to get clarified by this play-in round against the Minnesota Wild. But yes, he addressed the Judd Brackett situation.
There's been reports of, some form of breakdown in collaboration. When you hear those things, how do you respond to that sort of narrative?
It's all nonsense. It's that's not the way we do business. Since I took the job over, that's what we're all about is collaboration. You know, with our first two picks in every draft, like between myself, John Weisbrod, Judd Brackett, and all of our crossover scouts that, you know, we see those players either live or on video enough to and we collaborate on them. We talk about them and, you know, we come to an understanding always before, you know, we make those picks. So when I see this stuff that, you know, about collaboration and stuff, it's all just a bunch of nonsense.
And generally in these situations, the truth is somewhere in between when people are not coming out and talking in complete truths about it. Jim Benning's not going to tell us everything about the way he wants to structure his scouting staff or exactly what his feelings are on where Judd Brackett fits into it. And Judd Brackett has not said anything on the matter. People have asked for comment. He has not been made available. People would love to hear what Judd Brackett has to say. I'm not sure it serves him well or the Canucks well to make that happen, and so it hasn't to this point in time. But people always want to make this polarizing. Well, it's either there is complete collaboration and everyone's lockstep singing from the same hymn book, or they don't even talk. One guy has an opinion here, another guy has an opinion there, and there's zero communication. And generally, the truth's somewhere in between. So I believe Jim Benning when he says, man, are you serious? No collaboration? We talk. Of course we talk. It's ridiculous to think otherwise. And is there an element of maybe a change in what that collaboration looks like? Is there a change in what that collaboration should look like moving forward? The issue of autonomy in running a scouting department? Sure, that's very possible as well. I'm not saying there's nothing here, but I understand why Jim Benning says what he said yesterday, and you heard it here exclusively on your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Steven Brunt's going to join us in 20 minutes' time, and I want to get into a topic about that next, but I do want to bring Jamie Dodd in here. You know I'm really close to the situation. You've heard me bristle before when people use the term the media, but you and I do a lot of talking behind the scenes as well, Jamie. When you see something like the Brind'Amour situation yesterday, or even in this market, the context of the Judd Brackett situation, do you roll your eyes? Are you into it? Where are you at?
Well, for sure. I mean, the funny thing about the Brind'Amour one, you know, I was kind of buried in family stuff yesterday, and like I didn't really see any of the reaction to it. So my first introduction to it was listening to the clip. And if you just listen to the clip, like I had a hard time even believing that people were getting upset with him, because it's just such a kind of not bland, but it's just such a straightforward and understandable and reasonable thing to say. I mean, first of all, as you said, he was paraphrasing his players. But second of all, like the point of, hey, we accomplished X over 68 games and we don't necessarily think that should be thrown out. I mean, that's a very reasonable point. And again, as you said, it's not like they're taking their sticks home and refusing to play. They're going to play. They just kind of put their hand up and said, hey, this maybe doesn't make that much sense. So I find it hard to believe why anyone would have a problem with that. I know we all want hockey back, but yeah, of course, some teams, some players, some coaches, whatever, are going to have, you know, moderate, reasonable suggestions or points about the playoff format. So I don't think that's surprising at all. So yeah, in that instance, it's a little surprising. And, you know, with the Judd Brackett stuff, I've kind of just made my peace. That's the market we live in. And in a way, it's a really good thing. It's a good thing for you and me, ultimately, I think, because there is so much passion and interest in the Canucks that even a, you know, behind the scenes theoretical dispute between the general manager and the head amateur scout can become big news. Like, as much as we do want to roll our eyes to it, that's also, you know, that's a symptom of just how popular the Canucks are and how passionate fans are. So it's a good thing, even when sometimes it gets a little overheated and it gets a little bit ridiculous. But I've just kind of accepted that and say, like, hey, I'm glad we live in a market that's crazy about hockey.
I think the one thing that's very clear, whatever you happen to believe personally as a Canucks fan about where Judd Brackett and Jim Benning are at in this relationship or where they should be in this relationship, it's pretty clear by that answer yesterday that Benning is just sick of talking about it, that he doesn't want to continue to engage in this conversation, that he's more irritated by the fact this has become such a talking point than anything else.
Well, and especially it's not just the Brackett discussion has morphed from strictly being about will he return or won't he, and then it's grown to include things like, you know, Jim Benning and John Weisbrod are shutting him out. They're not collaborating with anyone else. They're ruling it with an iron fist. It's become a lot more speculative rather than simply talking about the contractual situation with Judd Brackett. And that, to me, I can understand why Jim Benning would be frustrated with that, because for the most part, and you know, there's reporters in the market who are very well sourced and are getting good information, but it's really hard for anyone on the outside who's not in those draft meetings to say with any sort of authority, this is how they go. This is who has the, you know, the final say in the draft room. This is how they collaborate. We just really don't know. So I can understand from Jim Benning's perspective, if he's hearing a lot of erroneous information, yeah, after a while that would get frustrating.
This one comes in from Matt and Langley to 650-650. I think Jim Benning put it best yesterday. The league wants to hand out a cup with integrity as fair as possible. That's not a verbatim quote, but I really don't think there's a solution that's fair for everyone. The league has come up with a way to award the cup that's as fair as possible and have really led the way as far as major sports leagues in North America. As far as I'm concerned, that is from Matt and Langley. I think most people see it the same way, and that's the way I think Rod Brind'Amour sees it as well. Hey, if you let me draw this whole thing up, that's not maybe exactly what I would have done, but I'm good with it. If we can play hockey, that's the bigger picture here. It's kind of why I thought there was this interesting and ironic juxtaposition of, hey, let's fall into this old clickbait way that we've been in before, right after we've been telling people for the last 2 months, you got to have perspective. Guys, you really need to have perspective here. I'm interested to get Steven Brunt's perspective on this next topic, because he is one of the most controversial athletes of the past 30 years, not Steven Brunt, but Lance Armstrong. He was once a cycling deity. He was a worldwide leader when it came to cancer fundraising. He was an American icon. He was finally proven to be the most elaborate cheat in cycling, if not sporting history. Come after him with tests, Lance Armstrong was going to beat those tests. And he was going to dare every single governing body to keep on testing. If you even infer the slightest manner that he was breaking the rules, he would tear your life, not to mention your finances, apart in order to keep his image intact. That was a very clear route that he would pursue each and every time. Eventually, we all know this, it all came crashing down, and Lance Armstrong was forced to admit he had done what everyone had accused him of doing all along. But that doesn't mean Lance Armstrong is off the hook. Just because you admit something doesn't mean you actually believe it. And this is the conversation I want to get into with Steven Brunt in about 15 minutes' time. And part of that comes from a clip from Christine Brennan, USA Today. She's been a columnist for years. She was on in Toronto earlier this week. We wanted to wait to have a good day to have this conversation. And Christine Brennan was among those because ESPN did an E60 and is doing an E60 on Lance Armstrong. It's a two-parter. The first episode aired last weekend. And Christine Brennan bristled at the fact they would take on this project. As she says, you can do whatever you want. I'm not going to tell you how to put your entertainment out there, but she questioned why ESPN would go down that road and what it would lead to.
This guy, Lance Armstrong, the worst or best cheater in sports history, one of the biggest liars and cheaters in the history of the world. And I can explain, because Lance transcended sports, of course, because of the cancer and just his profile for a few years, not just an athlete leaving the realm of sports to become such a part of our lives, especially the lives of cancer victims, survivors, their families, the hope, the faith they put in him as they read his books, as they had the drip in their arm with chemo. I mean, oh my God, I heard from these people when I was writing various columns about, I've covered obviously Lance for a long, long time. And anyway, and here he is, and it's basically the same nonsense, a bunch of malarkey. It's ridiculous. And it's kind of being this new thing, and okay, ESPN can do it. Again, every right to do it, of course. Anyway's mad at me. No, no, I get it. They can, of course they can do it. But why? You know, at a time when we're really looking at our lives and trying to find out what's important and thanking the doctors and the nurses and the frontline people in this incredible pandemic and the lives lost and on and on and on I can go. To give us this, a guy who starts out with saying, well, when my life took the turn that it took, that's how it starts. And by the way, you don't need to watch this, the second part. Believe me, I'm not going to be watching it on Sunday. It shocks everyone, I'm sure, that I won't. But when my life took the turn that it took is how he starts. That's how it starts. So whatever they chose, all the sound bites, that's what they use. How about, no, when I cheated and lied and ruined people's lives, when I duped cancer, no, nothing is ever about Lance, is it? Nothing. When my life took the turn that it took, yeah, it just must have taken a turn, that life of yours, and it just turned right into performance-enhancing drugs and lying and cheating. Shocking. It was the turn's fault. This guy never stops. And so that's why I lead with that in my column, which people can find on Twitter. And I just said, why in the world are we spending one more second of our lives dealing with this? And as a columnist, I had to, because, of course, my editors asked me to write it. So I did. The guy just never, ever, why we, in our short lives, we would spend any moments thinking about him. And the only reason we're doing it now, you guys call, I'm happy to talk, but also to hopefully tell people this is, it's not time to redeem him. It's not time to even give him a platform, in my humble opinion, to tell his story. What good does that do at this point, after all that we've been through with this clown?
So it's more than Lance Armstrong here. He is the subject in the focus of Christine Brennan because she was asked about him, but this leads to a bigger topic, and it's one I want to get into with Stephen Brunt. It's about redemption. It's about second chances. Who deserves those? There are a lot of controversial sports figures over the years. Some we have forgiven, not everyone, but by and large, there are some we have forgiven and allowed to move on. And there are others that were not so fast to get there. Lance Armstrong for Christine Brennan is a perfect example. Why is that? We'll get into it next right here on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
Baby, be my fire. Baby, be my flame. Baby, be the softly burning embers through December into June.
This one comes in from Mav in Victoria about forgiveness. How has Pete Rose not been forgiven? With all others that have been forgiven cheating or physically hurting loved ones or whatever, what Rose did seems pretty minor now. I'm glad you brought up Pete Rose. Moff, Scott Rintoul with you. Thanks for joining us here this morning. Stephen Brunt about to do so in just a couple minutes' time. Always appreciate the conversation with him. Pete Rose is similar to Lance Armstrong in this respect, in my opinion. Pete Rose has never shown an outward display of real contrition. And I believe that's what is at the heart of the second chance, the element of forgiveness. And Moth, you've seen enough, or maybe you didn't think Pete Rose's transgressions were enough that you'd be willing to put him in the Hall of Fame, or you'd be willing to forgive and forget. But why the public and why many people who have the authority to wield over Pete Rose have not gone down that road is because of genuine contrition. Are you actually sorry for what you've done, or are you only sorry you've been caught? And that is why people, by and large, haven't been able to fully get on board with Pete Rose. It's not just a time thing. There are athletes who have done what many would consider, and as you allude to in that text, Mop, far worse things than what Pete Rose did. And maybe that has to do with your feeling on gambling, or maybe you don't think he violated the integrity of the sport. But there are people, I'll throw one at you, Michael Vick. There are people out there who will never get past what Michael Vick did, what he was involved with dogfighting. And there are others who've said, well, Michael Vick did hard time in prison. We're not talking about some white-collar facility. Michael Vick did hard time. He went away. He lost X amount of years off of his career, X amount of earnings and all of the creditors that he had to pay back. And when Michael Vick came back, he seemed like he was genuinely sorry for what he had done, and he seemed like he was going to become a better person. So there were a lot of people who were willing to give Michael Vick that second chance, and they believed they saw a genuine form of contrition from Michael Vick. And that really is what the heart is at the heart of the matter, and that's what we're going to discuss with Stephen Brunt here when it comes to Lance Armstrong or Michael Vick or Pete Rose, Barry Bonds. Go down whichever road you want when it comes to judgment and whether or not we are willing to forgive and forget and move on. Stephen Brunt joins us now, one of the hosts of Writer's Block, of course, great author and our friend here on this program. Stephen, thank you very much for doing this. And as always, we ask if you and your family are safe and healthy at this time.
Yeah, very well, Scotty. We're all kind of managing and improvising a bit. The sun's shining, and there are signs of normal out there, right? You know, in sports and elsewhere. So I might as well take what you can get.
Agree with you wholeheartedly. And this, from a PR standpoint, has been a very good week for the National Hockey League. And it's kind of why we didn't get to this Lance Armstrong topic until today, because we've all been caught up in the revelry that Gary Bettman and company unfolded. Even though we know it's just a hypothetical at this point, we want to feel good about something, don't we?
Yeah, we do. And I think we want to see, you know, like it's every cliche applies here, right? But you want light at the end of the tunnel. You want to something to look forward to, even if it's in the distance. And you know, even if there are, you know, there's still hurdles to get over here for sure. Look, I thought from the beginning almost, like maybe not quite the beginning, maybe not from the days after everything crashed, but from early on that sports would resume because financially they have to, you know, like, if for no other reason, you know, it's the money that's left out would be left out there in terms of TV money is going to kind of force their hand. So they're going to find a way. I always thought that, but yeah, look, it could all still go sideways at some point. There are a million things that could happen, but I think the NHL kind of planting their flag and saying, we're going to do this and here's our plan, and doing it without, you know, without having to go to war with their own players so far. You know, if you contrast that what's happened in baseball the past week, it's a pretty stark difference there between those two sports.
It's night and day, and I do want to touch on baseball in just a moment here, but this is a league in the National Hockey League that hasn't always handled its PR or its messaging very well, and in this country we've been hypercritical about that. I've been really impressed during this entire pause with how measured they've been, how seemingly calculated they've been, and how proactive they've been when the time has presented itself to roll out their plans. I actually give them an A or an A-plus in all of this. How about you?
Me too. Yeah, straight up. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, you know, and as much as it was horrible, the getting there was horrible, and I understand why the players fought tooth and nail to stay out of a cap system. But the way that system is structured in, you know, again, this in a circumstance that none of us ever imagined, but it does... There's two things the NHL's economic system does. It forces some transparency in terms of revenues. So you know, the players do have the power to force teams to open their books because they have to declare hockey related revenue and share it with them at an agreed upon split. So they do have the right to actually know how much money is going in and coming out. And the other thing is leadership. You know, like. Gary Bettman and Donald Fehr have been perceived as bad guys by the sporting public for different reasons over the years, and because you know for doing their jobs as commissioner and as a union head, especially when Fehr was the head of the Players Association in baseball. But you know they are I think you have to give those guys credit in this circumstance for, again, I assume they are representing the interests of their bosses. And, you know, in Bettman's case, it's the owners, and in Fear's case, it's the players. But there's been this kind of sense of, look, we're stuck. We're in the same boat here. We do have an economic system where, you know, the players understand if there's a huge shortfall in revenue, it's coming back in escrow. You know, that's how the system works. They know that. They understand exactly what's going to happen to them, and the owners know on some level that they, you know, well, on every level that they need the players. The players are the product, and they have to look after their health and their safety, and they have to create an environment in which those guys feel, say, you know, secure. I know nobody's 100% secure these days, but secure enough to come back and go to work. So, yeah, two guys who I think have proven themselves to be pretty smart, strong leaders in this crisis, and a system that kind of forces them together, which, you know, is something, again, you don't necessarily have in other sports.
No, I've been really impressed, and actually find myself thinking positively about the future of CBA negotiations because of the way the players in the league came together on this. And maybe that's naive on my part, because when it comes to money, it is a little bit different. But the fact that they got in the room and there were concessions on both sides leads me to believe the game's in a pretty good place, especially when, as you said, you juxtapose it with what's happening in baseball right now. Steven, I agree with the players' stance. I just don't agree with their messaging. How should they be going about this?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm not sure. I think that they have been forced to react and to be reactive by what the owners have done here. And, you know, look, again, I know I understand people, it's a two-way street, et cetera, and these are unprecedented times and we are in a crisis. And if they don't come back to play and baseball goes away for a year, the consequences for that sport and that business are going to be horrific. So all of that, like, that's all a given. But, you know, remember that these are guys who, you know, they signed an agreement with the owners in March at the beginning of this, saying we will accept our prorated salaries for a shorter schedule. And, you know, there was an email exchange, you know, that the owners then leaked that had language about, what about if we don't have fans in the stands, we may have to revisit this because we won't have that revenue stream. But so, you know, they did agree to a concession right off the top. Then the owners leaked that email. The 50-50 revenue split proposal that, you know, was clearly a trial balloon from the owner's side that they floated, which they knew would be provocative for a group that had, you know, fought tooth and nail to stay out of any kind of a salary cap forever. And then they follow that up with a proposal at the beginning of this week, which, you know, it's kerosene on a fire, right? It's, you know, kind of attacks the stars of the game directly in terms of what their give back would be. And it was incredibly provocative. So, yeah, like, I'd rather not listen to the Blake Snell thing again. But I understand why they're mad. You know, I understand why they're really mad. I understand, you know, there's a story just broke of, you know, Scott Boras sent an email around to all of the players and to the union saying, don't bail the owners out here. You know, this is not, you know, these guys have reaped enormous profits over the last few years. Don't bail them out with your salaries. And I think that militancy grew tremendously in the last week because of what the owners have done here. And they know that the players don't want to be blamed for not having a season in the middle of a pandemic. But I think the way they've used it has been pretty darn cynical in the last few days.
Agree with you wholeheartedly. Steven Brunt joining us here today. I want to get into this Lance Armstrong topic and the thought of redemption or second chances. What do we need to see from athletes or public figures when it comes to allowing for second chances, Steve? And what qualifies as actual contrition?
Boy, that's a good question. It's a heck of a question. That's a societal question, not a sports question, isn't it? Like, you know, like, a lot of people get to have second act, right? And there's a lot of people get to come back from nearly anything. You know, you can go to jail and come back and remake yourself as a public figure or celebrity. Like, it happens. You know, sports has its own kind of moral code, I guess, in terms of the notion of, and I'm going to put it in air quotes here, cheating. But, you know, like, that's some, I've always said when it comes to PEDs, especially this, because this is really specific. You know, the line between what we accept as sports science and what we reject as cheating is is a blurry line, a dotted line. It's not absolute. It's arbitrary. And look, I have always thought that, you know, let's have a grown-up talk about PEDs. Let's not frame it in, you know, I think we should have learned something from the whole Ben Johnson thing, which is that, you know, blaming one guy or the people around him and kind of as being moral failures when they were operating entirely in a world of similar moral failures. And a lot of people knew about it. A lot of people turned a blind eye to it. I thought, you know, maybe that should have taught us a lesson. But, you know, that was a long time ago. But I guess, you know, I guess you could say, and I would tend to agree, the fact that Armstrong, because he wrapped himself in the cloak of, of being pure and, you know, living on a kind of moral high ground that nobody lives on, and you know, the whole, the foundation, and again, you could be as cynical as you want about his charity and all of the things that he kind of attached himself to suggest not just that he was clean, but that he was, you know, a virtuous person, a virtuous human being. And then to have lied the way he did. I understand athletes using PEDs, especially in sports that are dirty, like cycling. I understand the desire to compete on a level playing field with other people, and I understand some of the hypocrisy around the way we treat PEDs. But, you know, it's pretty hard to swallow Lance Armstrong just because of the other stuff, you know, because he went so far the other way.
And because when people came after him, Lance Armstrong wasn't only going to defend his name, he was going to tear down his accusers and did that. And it doesn't appear as though he has any remorse for any of that. And I guess that's where Pete Rose comes in. Not that he tore people down, but I think both guys are perceived by a lot of people as, you're only sorry you got caught. You're actually not sorry about anything else. And if that's where you're going to stand on this, I can't get on board.
Yeah, I guess the classic example during the baseball PED, I would say trials, but they weren't really trials. You know, there was a lot of leaks and, you know, reports that were, again, Major League Baseball leaking stuff out and outing players. But remember Andy Pettit, and nobody thinks of Andy Pettit now as a doper, because he came out and said, yeah, I did it. And I did it I was trying to recover to get back on the field to help the New York Yankees win a World Series. And that was it. Like, that was the end of it, right? Like, he was the anti-Roger Clemens, because nobody thinks of Andy Pettit as one of those, you know, one of that cast of characters anymore. And yet, he admitted he did it. So, there is kind of a pattern to, you know, kind of contrition and doing your penance. It's like Catholic confession, right? Like, you go in, you tell them what you did, they give you some prayers to say, and you're clean again. I think there's, you know, there is kind of that ritual that we expect, I guess. But, you know, it's, again, the standards seem to be, they do seem to be a little flexible depending on who you are and what you did and kind of what your attitude was, the way you, I'm not sure I would rather have somebody be kind of defiantly, you know, kind of defiant and silent like Roger Clemens, or somebody showing false contrition and, you know, trying to do a PR exercise to get themselves off the hook. I don't know, which is better?
That's a very good question, and I think what you said at the heart of it made me think of Hugh Grant back in the day when he got caught, and you know, he's with a prostitute, and he ends up going on The Tonight Show, and he just came out in front of the world and said, I'm an idiot. Like, I did this. I'm not going to run from it. And people went, oh, okay, you accept it, you take all the blame, and I guess we'll let you move on then.
Yeah.
It's kind of the best way to be.
Well, it is if you can do it. I think sometimes, you know, the world is predisposed. Like there might be other factors. You know, there may be other factors why a guy like Barry Bonds was, you know, who, you know, has never really been forgiven, and what he did, you know, his accomplishments are going to forever have an asterisk. But, you know, some of that has to do with Barry Bonds and whose records he was pushing aside and kind of how people felt about him. You know, sometimes it's not about the crime. It's about, you know, the person who's perceived to have committed the crime. So I wish everything was fair and level, but I'm not sure the world is fair and level.
Well, and a lot of that has to do with either side of the spectrum, doesn't it, Stephen? We need to get to this point where we understand that there are quote-unquote bad people who do good things, and quite opposite as well. There are good people who make mistakes, and sometimes they're big mistakes, and it doesn't necessarily mean they are awful human beings. I think we all know there's a threshold for most of us in certain categories. You cross that line, and we're not going back. But in most cases, it's a world of gray instead of black and white.
That's the big point. The world is gray. And, you know, context matters too, right? And, you know, again, to go back to the baseball stuff, you know, look, the difference between Pete Rose and all the PED guys is that the rule Pete Rose broke was written on the wall of every clubhouse in baseball. And the reason it's there goes back to the Black Sox scandal and a thrown World Series. And it says you can't gamble. You know, you can't. You can't do that. And if you do it, you'll be thrown out of baseball, essentially. So that is the most clear-cut rule that there is, and Pete Rose broke it, and that's why. And then he lied about it. Then he sort of admitted it, and you know. But that's why, you know, that's why justice was swift and decisive and, you know, unchanging so far. You know, PEDs were sort of against the rules in baseball, but the level of, you know, so many people were complicit, from the commissioner to the on-field personnel to the media. A lot of looking the other way, man. And I think context matters. That doesn't take you off the hook. You know, you can't just say, well, because the kid next to me did it, I did it, and therefore I'm not guilty. But there were a whole lot of people saying, you know, go ahead and hit those home runs, lads. It's good for business.
And what you're alluding to is something you mentioned earlier. As sports fans overall, we're generally hypocritical to a certain degree when it comes to this discussion. In baseball, hey, we can't have you taking steroids and breaking records like Babe Ruth and Hank Aaron. In football, okay, Julius Peppers, you were suspended for 4 games, but we're probably going to send you to the Hall of Fame anyway.
Well, yeah, and, I'm not sure what Hank Aaron, what Babe Ruth did, but and I'm not going to besmirch Hank Aaron directly, but players of Hank Aaron's generation in baseball took amphetamines like they were candy.
Oh, yeah. Right?
They're in the clubhouse. Amphetamines help you. You know, day game after a night game, amphetamines are very, very helpful. That is a performance-enhancing drug. All the same ball players, you know, the kind of Veterans Committee guys who railed against the PED users and didn't want them anywhere near the Hall of Fame, were many of those guys, if not all of those guys, were using amphetamines. I'm not sure what the difference is.
I think you and I are on the same page here with this, and it does feel like a chosen few who pay the price for the entire era. I guess it depends on what your view of what Cooperstown is supposed to be. Is it supposed to enshrine values as much as greatness, or is it just supposed to be a history of the game that maybe has a steroid wing, and maybe that's a bigger discussion?
Oh, well, yeah. If we're gonna do the Human Being Hall of Fame, I don't believe any of us are qualified. I'm not gonna be a voter on that one. I'm sorry.
That's a great point. Hey, Stephen, I always appreciate the conversation, and the only part I'm sorry about is that we run out of time. Have a great show today. Keep up the great work, and really appreciate you joining this one today.
Thanks, Scotty. Anytime, man.
That is Stephen Brunt, writer's block, awesome author as well, essayist. You know his work. He's been doing these great conversation pieces as well that you can find on sportsnet.ca. We want you in on our conversation. 650-650 is a place you can go. I played a Rod Brind'Amour clip earlier in this show, and I don't think it was controversial, though some made it out to be. I want to know if you agree with one of the other statements he made on a podcast that was released yesterday. And you'll hear it next right here on Sportsnet 650.
Welcome to the Scott Rintoul Show.
A lot of availability all of a sudden. And I get it. This is a time for good PR, and there has been good PR this week. But while the NHL has conducted relatively frequent but pretty regimented Zoom calls with certain players in the media, all of a sudden, once this plan is announced, everybody wants to talk to the players, everyone wants to talk to the coaches, the GMs, and everybody is seemingly available and having a little bit of fun with it. In some cases, Alex Killorn of the Tampa Bay Lightning, he released this video. It's about a 2-minute scene about the boys are back and the Bolts are back in town, and they're all picking up each other on jet skis and Sea-Doos, having a little bit of fun and showing off Tampa Bay a little bit as well. as has been pointed out by James Myrtle on Twitter. Just so you guys know, this is a little bit of maybe of a message to any free agents out there. Here's what life is like down in Tampa Bay. In other cases, players are talking about what their season doesn't hold or what it's going to be like for the next X number of months without hockey. Jack Eichel in Buffalo talking to the media today had this clip that was, listen, I'm fed up with the losing. I'm frustrated. It's been a tough couple of months. It's been a tough 5 years. I want to win the Stanley Cup every time I start a season. I'd be lying if I said I'm not getting frustrated with the way things are going. This story goes back to the beginning of the season, and it goes back to Connor McDavid and the story that has been following him around in Edmonton, the fear that if the Oilers don't make the playoffs more often, this was coming into the year, and obviously the Oilers have had a better year, and Edmonton fans and Ken Holland are confident they've turned a corner of sorts, and this is going to be a regular thing where they're either in the playoffs or competing for a playoff spot every single year, and that there's going to be postseason hockey in Edmonton. But people wondered, okay, is he going to ask out of town at some point? And that conversation soon went to the guy drafted after him, because unlike Connor McDavid, Jack Eichel has never been to the postseason. He's never won a postseason round. And he has steadily improved and has had breakout years either last year or this year, whichever one you want to consider his breakout year. And I pointed out on this show, and I think others did as well, that when Taylor Hall was traded, Jack Eichel's comments were very telling to me. And it wasn't, I'm asking out of Buffalo right now, but it was, this bears watching. Jack Eichel said something to the effect at the time of, yeah, I completely understand it. You want to win a cup. You get to a point in your career where you want to be in the playoffs. I totally understand where he's coming from. And now he has comments like this. It's not I'm out of town, but it's you're on notice. And at what point is that fair? At what point is it, okay, guys, I've given you X number of years, and we haven't been able to get there. Maybe it's time for a change for everyone. Nobody wants to lose their star player. Sabres fans don't want to lose Jack Eichel. But at what point do you side with the player and say, you know what, you're right. Go somewhere else. You don't deserve this. I don't think Buffalo's quite there, and there are some encouraging signs with the Buffalo Sabres, but it does feel like next season, whatever that season looks like, and again, much like this format that's going to play out at some point in time, it's going to come with context. Well, next season's going to start later, and maybe it's not 82 games, and who knows what the format's going to be moving forward. But it does feel like one of those litmus tests for Jack Eichel and the Sabres organization as to where they proceed after that. He's handsomely compensated, and he certainly holds up his end of the bargain in Buffalo, but where do they go at some point with Jack Eichel? You want in on that? You can hit me up, 650-650. Or maybe on this. Rod Brind'Amour yesterday was on the ESPN podcast with Greg Wyshynski and Emily Kaplan. This isn't the quote that was getting all the run that people were talking about that some thought was controversial, which I, by the way, do not think was controversial. But I did think it was interesting to hear Rod Brind'Amour talk about the playoffs relative to the regular season and which aspect of this entire journey most years is tougher than the other. Have a listen.
The hardest thing about winning the Stanley Cup is just, to me, is getting into the playoffs. That's your first stage. You go, you know, you play 82 games, you go 7 months or 6 months to get into that. Then I think it's wide open. I mean, I think getting in is the hardest thing. So they've established that 24 teams essentially have gotten in my opinion. I think it you know, you can reseed, you can do whatever you want. I really don't know that it's going to make much difference in my opinion, especially when you're taking away, well, I would think you would take away anything so-called home court advantage or home ice advantage. I mean, there's just so many other variables now that are popping in that I don't think that, you know, it matters much.
If you present it to most hockey fans as such, what's harder, getting in the playoffs or winning a Stanley Cup? Everybody's going to vote for winning a Stanley Cup. But Brind'Amour's point is a really good one, and I do think it's something that in hockey specifically, but moreover in North American sports, we don't give teams enough credit for. We don't give teams enough credit for making the playoffs. It's only whether or not you win or go a significant amount of a distance in the postseason dance that we give you any type of credit. But Brind'Amour's point is a good one. Man, you scratch and claw for 6 months to try to get in. And it's really difficult to be good enough for that long to qualify for the postseason. But that's not the way we look at it. And I don't know if that's just because we look at the end prize, or because playoff hockey is played a different way, or because if you're in my age category, you grew up at a time where the playoffs were a given. And maybe that's part of the backdrop here as well, Jamie. I grew up at a time when 16 of 21 teams got into the playoffs. Nobody said anything about it. Nobody laughed, really, at the NHL that the format was only five teams missed. When you think about it in that context, you had to work really hard not to be a playoff team back in the 80s when there were only 21 teams. But it was always about the postseason. And maybe it has something to do with that tradition. Now we are at a far different ratio, and some people want the playoffs expanded, and some people want it to remain just 16 teams. I still don't think we give teams enough credit for that six-month battle year in and year out. Look at the Minnesota Wild, for example. They've never really done anything in the playoffs save for that 2003 run, but they're there almost every single year, and we actually discount it and kind of brush the Wild off in many respects, don't we?
Well, I think it's related to the idea that, you know, what people call it rings culture or whatever you want to say. And the idea that there is only one good team every year, that's the team that wins the championship, and every other team are a bunch of chokers and losers, right? And that's kind of how we've come to view it. And teams that are able to sustain just like a moderate, or not even moderate, but a good level of success, a good level of performance for, you know, 5-10 years, if they don't win the championship, there's still this idea that, but they're chokers. Like, look at the Sharks. They still have to wear that label. The Capitals, before they got over and won, they had to wear that label. And I absolutely think you're right, that really discounts just how difficult it is to be competitive, to be in the playoffs constantly over a span of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. You know, on a one-off basis, just a team making the playoffs for 1 year, I think we assign roughly the same amount, the right amount of credit to that. You know, we say, okay, that's an accomplishment, but maybe you could have done more, or is it sustainable? I think that's fair. It's when teams are able to sustain that for a period of time and we still don't give them the credit, that doesn't make that much sense to me, because it absolutely is hard, especially now in the salary cap era, to be at that baseline level for a long time.
Well, you've heard me say this on this show many, many times, and I'll continue to, because I think it's true. I think the most difficult thing to do in sports is replicate success. As you said, anybody can have a season where you get to the playoffs, or have one playoff run, or have that one career year. Can you do it again? And can do it again after that. And that's what distinguishes the great from the good, or very good. And it's actually what you outlined there, Jamie. And a team like the Minnesota Wild, to me, is the best argument for the type of lottery system that the NHL has in place. Brian Burke's been outspoken on this, and he wasn't going to make it a major talking point this week. But every time he was asked about it, he did say, yeah, look, I think everybody knows my feelings on the lottery. I think that there should be very few teams that are involved in getting the top pick. And if you have a bad year, you should get that. But the Minnesota Wild, to me, is the perfect example of why it shouldn't be that way. If you exist in this murky middle where you never quite win a cup, but you're never bad enough to bottom out, should we say you don't have a chance to get that type of talent that's going to put you over the top? Should we just say you're always going to be drafting 11 or 12 and that you can only use these other mechanisms we have in the league to get better, while the other teams... It reinforces this culture to me, which I don't believe in, which is you got to be really bad to eventually be good.
It does. At the same time, the fact that teams are able to replicate their success in some situations is a testament to the idea that you don't have to bottom out. You can, if you're smart, if you're competent, you can be good over a long period of time. Now, even for certain teams that have had that sustained period, you know, we've seen them miss the playoffs once in that span. You know, certainly the Capitals, the Sharks have both been in that situation. And I think the key is, you know, when you do have that little bit of dip, you got to strike while the iron's hot. You have to use that opportunity not to tear everything down, not to tank, but to reload a little bit, to hit on a draft pick if you happen to get a top 10 pick, to hit on, you know, okay, this is an opportunity to make a trade, to sign a free agent. You really have to be opportunistic in those moments, because, you know, if you just try to keep the band together forever, and that's so tempting when they've had success, but eventually that just doesn't work. You always have to be looking to refresh your roster.
He is the producer of this program. Jamie Dodds put together another fantastic program today. I'm Scott Rintoul. You want in on any of that? 650-650 is the number to text. Let's get to CSI Sports here, and we are going to take a turn, and we're going to focus on a play from the National Football League. And a guy who is not David Tyree, not Buster Douglas, in no way, shape, or form, is Antonio Freeman, a one-hit wonder. He got 477 passes. He racked up well over 7,000 yards. He scored more than 60 touchdowns in the regular season in his career, not to mention that 81-yard TD in the Super Bowl. But like Tyree or Douglas, there's this ink blot test with certain athletes. You mention their name, and a specific player moment springs to mind. And when I saw Antonio Freeman was celebrating a birthday yesterday, the first image I thought of was this one.
Favre lays it up for Freeman, and it's incomplete. He make the catch at the 15?
Yes.
What are they going to rule it? He caught it? Touchdown! He did what?
Ref was right on it, I think. Oh, man.
Man, how did Dishman not intercept it? Well, the Packers are going wild. The crowd's going wild. I mentioned there's nothing to challenge, but they'll have to look at it upstairs. Pantak, well, he's laughing, but let's see what it shows on the replay. It never hit the ground.
Monday Night Football, Packers and Vikings, November of 2000. Game was tied at 20 in overtime. Antonio Freeman makes a catch that left both the booth, as you just heard, and the viewing audience, and I was watching that game live, probably as many of you were, somewhat dumbfounded as to what exactly happened. So let's have a closer look and listen at one of the wilder walk-off plays you will ever witness in a football game.
Favre lays it up for Freeman, and it's incomplete. Did he make the catch at the 15?
Yes.
What are they going to rule it? He caught it? Touchdown! He did what?
Let's start with the throw. Packers have the ball at the Vikings 43-yard line, 3rd and 4. Remember, it's overtime. Favre has a 3-receiver set with a tight end, single back on the field. Freeman is the lone receiver to Favre's right. Vikings decide to blitz. They also play man coverage, so Favre has a slight roll to his drop back to the right side as he locks in on his favorite receiver. Freeman takes an outside release. He runs a go route against Chris Dishman, and Favre lofts the ball up for Freeman, and quite frankly, it's a bad throw. The one you don't want to locate a deep ball, that's where you don't want it to be. When your receiver is running outside, the one place you don't want it is exactly where Favre puts it. He throws it inside and on the body of the cover man.
It hit the back of Antonio Freeman.
Watch the left guard
bring the ball up in the air, and he's 6 inches off the grass.
What a catch.
Unbelievable awareness of where the ball is.
We are
his body.
Once again, we are reviewing the play on the field.
Ball went through Dishman's hands.
He never hit the ground. Yeah, never hit the ground. Because as Dishman turns back to look for the ball, he's in great shape to pick it off, even though his turn to look back is super awkward. As a result, he only gets his right hand on the ball instead of both of his mitts. Freeman gets boxed out from the ball, and then he makes a half-hearted dive. It's almost as though he's hoping Dishman misses the pass completely. So that's why Freeman is face down on the grass when Dishman deflects the ball down to what usually would just be the turf. The ball hits the back of Freeman's left shoulder pad. It rolls down his left triceps as Freeman is rolling onto his right side. He then reaches out with his right hand as he suddenly spots the ball. He taps the ball over to his left hand, and he's squeezing it with both as Dishman is busy coasting toward the end zone, lamenting his missed interception. And that's why no one is anywhere near Freeman once he gets up, jogs into the end zone for the game-winning score.
No, it's just a great fluky play for the Pack.
Pantak hasn't even gotten over to the... And then there's no contact.
Dishman didn't even tidy up afterwards. He just assumed that it hit the ground.
You couldn't film that scene in a movie and make it look that good.
Touchdown.
I guess you could say Favre's pass was free-falling. It's an incredible play, Jamie, and one I hadn't revisited in a very long time. And even though you have to go watch it in standard def, and it's kind of comical to do that with many of these plays we do, just given how great the clarity is on most of the images we watch here in 2020, that catch is among the best I have ever seen.
It's incredible. And you nailed it off the top when you said it's the first thing you think of when you hear Antonio Freeman's name is that catch. And that's exactly what my experience was like when you texted me the clip. I was like, oh, I know what this is going to be. And I'm excited because it's awesome. And it's one of those plays where it's hard to wrap your head around the physics of it. And putting aside the incredible job by Antonio Freeman, because it's a remarkable catch and the concentration and the coordination and all that. But just like there's a moment where the football hits his shoulder and it just seems to kind of stick there and like hover above the ground almost. And I just don't really understand how it happens. It's insane to see it in real time. And again, this is one of those calls where the announcers nail it and you can hear Al Michaels. He almost sounds like upset in a way, but just he's so blown away by what he just saw. He can't even believe it. And he really matches the moment, because even going back, you know, however many years later now and watching it, it's still hard to figure out exactly how it happened.
David Tyree often gets credit for the greatest catch in Super Bowl history. We did that Seahawks final drive that ends up in the Malcolm Butler interception. If the Seattle Seahawks score a touchdown there, people talk about the Jermaine Kearse catch probably in the same manner, or at least in close context to David Tyree's, because it ends up helping them win a Super Bowl. But because the Seahawks didn't, people almost forget about that catch. And I think people almost forget about this catch. Not the same stakes, but it was Monday Night Football's overtime. It was a great play. You want in on it? Hit us up, 650-650. Let's get to what they're saying.
Bro, what are you talking about, man?
What are you saying?
Not saying anything.
You're saying something?
I guess that's what I'm saying, Brooksy.
Here's what they're saying.
We're going to have a couple of months to chew on this playoff format, and people are going to talk about wrinkles they like, wrinkles they don't. They haven't worked everything out yet. There is one part of it that I still think is not quite fair, and we'll see if they iron out any of those wrinkles or they just move ahead with this reseeding in the top four. But Nick Foligno of the Columbus Blue Jackets was on in Toronto today, and he was asked about something that I think is going to come out of this, and I think many people within the game think is going to come out of this, though traditionalists probably oppose it. And that's having more teams in the playoffs, having some type of play-in round, though probably not as widespread as this one is going to be. Foligno was asked whether players would support having more playoff teams in the future.
You know, I want to see how this one plays out, but I mean, it's interesting. I think we've always said, and I think other teams have even said it too, like you'd love to have more teams involved in the dance in the postseason. And the only thing you don't want to take away is the integrity of the game, the history of it. You know, the other, you know, seasons where it was the 16 teams, the four rounds, you know, to keep that, you know, that history and the way the game has been played for so long, I think that's important, the integrity of it. So I wonder how we can make that work. But I think it'll be really cool to see if this, you know, is something that excites everybody. You know, players, fans. If this, you know, goes off the way we hope it will, then yeah, there might be something to it that we can hopefully put into something down the road, maybe, and bring in more teams. I think that's, you know, and I listen to everyone say, oh, it's a joke. You got 24 teams. Some of these teams shouldn't even be in. I mean, this is unprecedented times, so I don't really buy. You can't go by the way of old. You know, we got to try to find a way to make amends on a situation that none of us could have foreseen, right? And allow teams a chance to play in and put your money where your mouth is. You know, I think that's a great opportunity for a lot of teams. Like, if you say you're as good as you are and have a chance to be in it, then win. You know, and that's all that's expected of us. And if you're that worried about all the situations, then are you that confident in your group? You know, so that's the way it comes down to. The best team is going to win the Stanley Cup if we go back, and that's just the way it is. And there's always circumstances in every playoff format. You know, there's injuries and all those things that play into it. So this is a way for us to have more competitiveness and more teams involved and more fun, and a way to engage a bigger fan base that, you know, is yearning for hockey and excited to get hockey back.
There's a guy who gets it. There's a guy who gets it. And hey, we do have to respect the tradition. We have to respect the integrity of what this tournament has been and should continue to be for the future. However, things change. I talked about the 16 of 21 teams. That was 76% of the teams in the league getting into the playoffs every single year. And we didn't have a problem with it. We romanticized that era of hockey, in fact, of 80s hockey and how great it was and the great teams that came out of it. And there were great teams, but we didn't have a problem then. And this has changed along the way. As more teams have been added, when you go back to the 60s and what was a six-team league and then expanded again. There have been changes in the game. Do you upset the integrity of the tournament? Do you upset the integrity of the Stanley Cup? And at the same time, how do you make your regular season worth a little bit more? And it's part of the reason I think that they will have a play-in round after this year. I think they will have a smaller one. Maybe it's 20 teams, and those bottom four teams in each conference are playing off with a way to get into the 7 and 8 seed. I think it actually gives more value to the regular season if those top two teams in each conference get a bye while everybody else has to play a little bit. Just my belief. We'll see where it goes from here. You juxtapose what's happening and what a great week it has been for the National Hockey League with what is happening in baseball right now. And while I agree with the player's stance of, you already told us we were going to take a prorated salary this year, and now you're trying to do it again. I understand the distrust because it does feel like the owners are trying to take more of an advantage of this situation. And I think if you put yourself in the place of an employee, which most of us are, you will actually sympathize with the players overall. But people see players who make millions of dollars complaining about their wages, and they roll their eyes and they say, I don't want to hear it. Shai Davidi, baseball insider for Sportsnet, had this to say about baseball and the thought that where we're at right now, maybe this doesn't get done.
Well, you'd think that ultimately they figure this out, and I have to believe that they do in the end. But, you know, this is baseball. They've gone about their games the usual way, you know, conflict, public manipulation of trying to manipulate the other side in through public leaks and stuff like that. And ultimately, you know, they seem to be on track to do things they always do, is like, you know, just screwing around playing games right up until there's a deadline that forces them to make a decision at the very end. But there's just too much at stake for both sides. You know, the players can't take essentially a zero on the year. The owners can't let their business sit idle and expect to return in a year's time without significant damage being done, not knowing what the economic landscape is going to be when they return, because it's no guarantee fans are going to be able to attend games even next year. So, you know, there's just too much incentive ultimately for both sides to find some middle ground. And, you know, just based on their past history, it's understandable that each side would stake out maximalist positions at this point in time.
I agree with Shai. A lot of this has to do with their history and the gap in trust that exists between these two factions. And I also agree with him that I do think eventually people will see the forest for the trees here and say, it's going to cost everybody if we don't play this year, because I am of the belief, and I know people disagree with me, certainly some of you do, I think they will have more trouble recovering from this if the perception is it was about money than they did recovering from the strike in the mid-90s. Baseball's in a way worse spot right now. A way worse spot. There are a lot of people who don't want to watch the game to begin with because they think it's boring now, that it's become too low event for them, that it moves too slowly. You couple that with a fight over money, at least that's the way it's perceived, you're going to have a really difficult time getting fans back if and when they're able to return in the next couple of years. Brendan Morrison joins us every single Thursday. We'll get his thoughts on any aspect of this format he doesn't like, or if he loves it and what he sees coming out of it, and also his thoughts as a player who was interviewed day in, day out, and whether or not he ever took issue with the way the media treated his comments. That's next right here on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
We do it on CSI Sports when we go back, we look at a moment, we look at a drive, we look at a particular game, something in sports history that is extremely memorable for whatever reason. And you see the old viz at times and you kind of chuckle at certain aspects of it. Maybe it's a certain type of attire, maybe it's just the way that players wore their uniforms, all these different things. Anthony Stewart Full props to the Hockey Central member, former national hockey leaguer, I should say. So Alex Killorn, as I mentioned earlier in the program, he tweeted out this video, and it's the Tampa Bay Lightning getting back together, and they're on Sea-Doo's jet skis down in Tampa. They're all riding around the Bay Area there. Great stuff. Great, awesome visuals. Fun. Anthony Stewart tweets out the early 2000s intro video that the Florida Panthers had back in the day. It is incredible. It is so bad that it is good. And a couple of our favorites are in it. Alex Auld is in it. He's actually the second guy you see after Olli Jokinen. Todd Bertuzzi's in it. It is awesome. So it's obviously after the Roberto Luongo deal. It's after that. So it's not that long ago. Anthony Stewart said early 2000s, but this is a little bit later. This is talking about, you know, I don't know if it's from 2007, 2008, whatever it is. It is fantastic. I encourage you to go to my timeline. I have retweeted it, I should say. Or you can follow Anthony Stewart, who is at Stu Monroe on Twitter. It is awesome. If you are one of those people who thinks the worst TV is actually the best TV, this is for you. And to see Aldi and to see Bert in this video is awesome stuff. Marty Jelena's in there, Brian Allen. Some blasts from the past. Brendan Morrison set to join us here momentarily. Any aspect of this format that people are not crazy about? I know it depends on what market you're in, and you're going to look at it through that lens. If you're a Carolina Hurricanes fan, or you're a Lightning fan, or you're a Canucks fan for that matter, then there might be a little thing you have to quibble with here or there. Where's Brendan Morrison on the whole idea as he joins us from Tofino? Mo, thanks for doing this. I imagine you and the family still safe and healthy over there on the island?
You know what? We are safe and healthy. We made a move back to Calgary here this past week. We had to get back here and take care of some business here. But, yeah, the trip was good. I know, you know, things are a certain bit quiet everywhere, but, yeah, I mean, for us, it's just, you know, just keep social distancing and wait to hear what health authorities have to say as far as things opening up.
Well, I'm glad you made a safe move back and that you guys are back settled in your normal residence back in Calgary. Let's talk about what has been a very good week of public relations for the National Hockey League. They roll out the format and the lottery. Let's start with the format itself. 24 teams. There's a 16-team play-in round. There isn't going to be any weighting given to that. And then there's also the possibility of these top four teams in each conference reseeding. Let's start with the play-in round. As a player, as a former player, do you have any issue with it?
You know what? I think given the circumstances, I think this is the best solution. Like, I've been kind of going over it today and dissecting it. But, I mean, really, I don't know what else you can do, really. Whatever decision I think the NHL made, you're not going to satisfy 100% of the people. But for the most part, I think this was very well guided, and I think they made a pretty good call. And I think it's going to be interesting if they can move forward and play. Obviously, there's some things that need to be resolved, and it's been talked about the health and safety of the players and everybody, you know, the coaches, training staff, et cetera. But I think if they can get this off the ground, I think it will be very, very exciting. It'll be unprecedented. You know, it's never been done, obviously. I don't think they're ever going to do it again. But I think it will be exciting for fans.
I know it might depend on where you are in your life, let alone your career, Mo. But yourself personally, if a situation like this had arisen for you, do you think at the top of your list would have been, hey, we need to have a format that's fair and equitable, the best we can do? Or would health and safety been your primary concern?
Well, health and safety is always number one. I mean, that's the biggest thing. I mean, without that, I mean, you really don't have anything. I mean, it's anybody who's gone through situations with, you know, themselves or family members that are, you know, dealing with health issues. I mean, it's, you can have all the money in the world, but if you don't have your health, then, I mean, you can't do anything. So that's number one. So if they can get that locked down, then I think it'll be exciting. Like, I really do. It kind of, you know, that, like a tournament style, a bit of a play-in. Yeah, I think the hockey fans will gravitate towards it and really eat it up.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. Brendan Morrison joining us here, as he does every single Thursday on Sportsnet 650. So I asked you from a player standpoint, what about from a hockey fan standpoint? There are some that aren't quite resolved on, hey, if you get bounced from the playoff round, you're also in the NHL draft lottery. Should those three spots atop the draft lottery not get claimed by teams that aren't even in this playoff round? Do you have any issue with that at all as a fan?
Well, maybe a bit. Like, if you qualify for the playoffs, I don't know if you should be qualifying for the lottery with the system in place this year. I think if you're not in it, then your odds should, depending on your standings, your odds should increase, and you should have a better chance at that draft position.
So there are those teams that are at either end of the spectrum, right? No one's going to be okay if the Edmonton Oilers lose in a best-of-five play-in and then somehow get the number one overall pick because they've had so many number one overalls. And the Edmonton Oilers probably don't deserve that. Same with, like, the Toronto Maple Leafs. Then there's the other side of it, and that's the, hey, Montreal, there was no chance Montreal was getting in the playoffs. There's no chance Chicago was getting on the playoffs, and yet those teams could make an unprecedented run. Are you of the opinion they shouldn't have any business in the tournament? Or, look, if you can win what might be 19 games to win a Stanley Cup at this time of the year, fill your boots.
I mean, again, it's a tough call, but I think if you've actually qualified for the playoffs, then you should be out of the running for the lottery pick or a chance at a high lottery pick. I mean, that's just a decision that's made. And I think, I don't believe if a team like Chicago goes on a deep run that they should still be able to qualify for a lottery pick. No.
Well, they won't. They won't.
Exactly.
If they win that play-in round, they're out of it all of a sudden. But that means Edmonton's in.
Well, yeah, I know. I hear what you're saying there. I don't know. I haven't thought about that one too much. I mean, based on the where Edmonton finished so much higher than Chicago, then no, they should not be allowed to be in the lottery process. And I almost think there should be something in place where if you get the number one pick, one year, you can't get the number one pick next year. I don't know. I don't have the exact formula, but I mean, Edmonton kind of had that weighted ball there for a couple of years and managed to pull out that number one pick for a while there. But I'd have to think about that a little bit more.
So you said earlier in the interview that there's never going to be anything quite like this again. And while I agree with that, I could see aspects of this format, if they're able to play, bleeding over into future playoffs. I can see a play-in round after this year. And part of the reason I can see it, Mo, not only do you keep more teams involved and that generates more revenue if you're putting, say, your 7 and 8 spots in each conference on the line and you're allowing teams 9 and 10 to have an opportunity to grab one of those. I also think it rewards the teams at the very top of the standings as well. Teams 1 and 2 in each conference, you're going to get a more tired team that's had to play its way in, but you're also going to get a little more rest, and it almost makes the regular season more valuable, in my opinion. From a player's point of view, would you want that, or is it too much time off? How do you see it?
Well, I agree with both your statements there, but number one thing for me is why I think the league and the PA would agree to it is revenue. That's the number one driver. There's going to be a huge question mark moving forward about revenues. There's already huge question marks right now about escrow, what's going to be happening, with players and how much are they going to be giving back, off their current paychecks. I mean, nobody really knows these answers for now. I think we talked about it previously that, I think over the last 5 years, the players have given back an average of like 11% of their salaries due to escrow. And it was always a funny thing, even when I played, when we first came out of the lockout, we actually got a small percentage more than what your contract was worth, one time ever in this new system. And then, as you pay into this escrow pot every, throughout the course of the year, essentially, when I played, there were times when they would just take 15% off your check, which was kind of, put into this escrow account and it was out of sight, out of mind, knowing that you were going to lose some of that based on revenues at the end of the year. Well, come September when training camp opened and you would get some of that money back depending on what the escrow figure was, it was like, I've never seen guys so happy getting this check. And I'm like, boys, this is your money. Like, this isn't like a bonus coming back to you. Like, this is actually your money. You've actually just paid money to the league. So it's kind of a, it's a weird dynamic. I mean, you have to think it through. And that's going to be a huge issue, I think, moving forward in the next collective bargaining agreement is the escrow. And I'm sure players are going to want to cap it at some rate.
Maybe the two aren't related, but my general feeling coming out of this is that the players in the league worked so well on this return to play plan together, and there were concessions made on both sides as they negotiated what it was going to look like along the way, that it has me optimistic about future CBA talks, that both sides have shown a willingness to hear the other side and make concessions. Should we not relate those whatsoever because one's about actual hockey and the other is about business?
Yeah, I would say that's a fair statement. I mean, when it push comes to shove, I mean, it's not just about getting on the ice and playing the hockey. The business aspect of it creeps in, and when you're talking about the huge amount of dollars that you're talking about with hockey, you know, billions of dollars here, that factors into it. And just being frank, I mean, that's the number one issue when that comes to the table.
Brendan Morrison joining us here today, as he does every single Thursday on Sportsnet 650. There are some people talking about Jack Eichel, and I don't think this is a new story. He basically expressed his frustration today that, once again, on the outside looking in with the Buffalo Sabres, and that's always led to the next question. Well, is Jack Eichel going to ask out? You're a guy that, for different reasons in your career, asked for a trade at some point. What do you feel you owe to an organization as far as terms of service before you're within your rights to go and say, hey, I need a better opportunity for whatever reason?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, Jack Eichel's coming off two incredible seasons and, you know, has really kind of cemented himself for the last couple of years as being one of the elite players in the game, or at least getting to that stage. You know, prior to that, you know, I mean, he showed flashes, but his consistency wasn't there night in, night out. But he's really taken a big step forward his last 2 years. So, I mean, you can see where he's coming from with his frustration. Now, you know, I might be a little bit more privy to the Buffalo situation just because one of my good friends, Jason Botterill, is the general manager of that team. And I know when Boston inherited that team, they were in shambles. I mean, they had no depth in their American League system. And he knew when he took that job, it was going to be a huge project. I mean, we had that conversation, and I don't think I'm saying anything out of line that he wouldn't tell you. But, you know, I think what has happened there the past two seasons and why frustration is so high, it coupled with the fact they haven't made the playoffs for, I think, 9 years now, is, you know, they've kind of fooled their fan base a little bit with a couple of runs they went on. Like, you know, 2 years ago, they went on like a 10-0 run there. And then last year, I think they went 9-2-2. So, you know, I mean, as a fan, you think right away, like, geez, I mean, this is the year. And then they crumbled both times and had long stretches where they couldn't put it together. But, you know, I'm not trying to make excuses for Buffalo. They need to get a little bit deeper. I think they're starting to develop and drafting better here the last couple of years. You know, they had a couple of injuries this year that affected them. You know, when Olsen went out, one of their top goal scorers, and their goaltender was hurt for a while. And, you know, they have some nice young pieces again on the back end with Dahlin and Eichel up front. I mean, he's a young kid. I mean, he's frustrated. I mean, especially this season when you're looking at it, how they did the format, they missed the playoffs by 3 points, right? Like Montreal beats them by 3 points. And you're sitting there replaying in your head, well, you know, how many games did we blow or you know, how many games should we have won when we could have been in the playoffs? You know, if Buffalo all of a sudden made the playoffs this year, I think the mindset completely changes. Hey, we got a chance now and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, when that doesn't happen, then it's doom and gloom. But, you know, I think Jason is a smart guy. I know he's a smart guy. He was one of the guys that helped architect that kind of Penguins dynasty there. He was a capologist and assistant GM there for a lot of years. So, I mean, he knows what he's doing. I mean, I think he's handcuffed the first couple of years. He took over from Tim Murray that I don't know if they did the best job there. That's just my opinion from afar. And I think they'll get straightened out here.
Mo, at the other end of the spectrum is a team that always makes the playoffs, and it's the Boston Bruins. Best overall record this year, most points, and they had an 8-point cushion in the Eastern Conference standings. So part of the format that was rolled out a couple of days ago was, hey, these top four teams in each conference, they're going to play each other in a round robin, and that's going to determine seeding for the conference. Is that fair?
I mean, I don't know how else to do it, right? Like, I mean, you know, I think it's exciting for those guys to have a chance to compete against the other elite teams and kind of, I don't know. I know I'm kind of being wishy-washy here, not making a firm decision, but I'll go with, yeah, I think it's probably the right thing to do given the circumstances is have that. And then you have, there's no excuses and no one complaining after the fact that, hey, we should have been there, you shouldn't have been there. Well, you guys played head-to-head, and if you wanted to be there, you should have won those games. So that's kind of settled that argument.
Well, I guess there's two issues. One is, hey, should an eight-point gap be allowed to be made up in three round-robin games coming off a layoff? So that's one aspect of the argument. The other aspect is this. Does it really matter where you're seated in the playoffs anymore? And Rod Brind'Amour kind of touched on this the other day, where he said yesterday, a podcast that was released, he said, look, I'll be honest with you, it is so hard to make the playoffs now that I think that's the hardest part of winning a cup is just getting into the playoffs, because once you get there, the field is wide open. Do you share that view?
I do. I do believe that. I think parity in the league is at an all-time high. I mean, even towards the end of my career back in, you know, 2012, the mentality was if you get in, you have a chance. And I think that's even more so today. You know, when I first came into the league, there were nights when you'd play games that you knew if you were on a good team and half of your team showed up and played well, there was a very good chance you're going to win that game. Those days are long gone. You need everybody every night kind of pulling on the rope. I mean, you can get by on certain nights when you have, you know, some dynamic duos in the league that just put the team on their back and single-handedly win games. But, you know, 95% of the time, you need contributions from everybody in your lineup if you're going to win.
Is there a particular style of team you would fear in the format that's been laid out? Or because we've never seen anything like this before, is it so impossible to predict that you just say, flip a coin, man?
A good defensive team. They're always the most dangerous team with good goaltending. I always think it's easier to go back to playing good defense than it is to scoring goals. You know, anybody can really play defense if you put your mind to it and you commit to it and, you know, you're willing to compete and play hard. I mean, but at the other end of the spectrum, scoring goals, not everybody can do that. It's a different mentality, different skill set, essentially. So I think teams that have a good back end with good goaltending are the most dangerous teams.
What's the most difficult you've had, Mo, going from 0 to 100 in terms of jumping into a situation? Because that's what it's going to be with the intensity of these games. Guys are going to go from training camp, not easing into that first level of the regular season. They're trying to go into playoff hockey mode right away. What in your career is the closest you can think that comes to that?
You know, probably coming back after an Olympic break when you've had 10 days and, you know, you're obviously first couple of days, you're kind of just depending on the situation, just rest, recharge, but then you're training. But a lot of times guys will, you know, be off the ice. And if you're off the ice for more than 3 days during the season, it feels like you've been off for 2 months. And so coming back, I think mid season after the Olympic break and getting into competitive games right away, it's an eye opener. Like a lot of sore hip flexors, you know, some groin injuries. So, I mean, I think that's going to be paramount when they talk about the health and safety of players, is giving them enough time, the so-called mini training camp, to kind of recondition their bodies again, because skating is a very unique activity and exercise, and you can do anything you want off the ice, but nothing mimics skating.
Very quickly before I let you go, complete right turn. Back in the mid-80s, Rick Hansen, he's going to join the program next, and we're going to talk about his rise through sports and everything that he's overcome along the way. Did you go out and see Rick Hansen back in the day in the Man in Motion Tour when he rolled through your town?
Absolutely, I did. I remember it vividly, and him being such a huge inspiration. And you know, it was talked about a lot in schools, right? About kind of his mission. And it was a guy, I think, that gave a lot of people hope, right? And showed, you know, similar, I guess, to Terry Fox in a sense that, you know, he was really a champion, showing, proving to people that, hey, you can accomplish a lot of things when you put your mind to it. And I mean, if you think about, you know, what he did there, it's absolutely amazing. And I know, I don't know Rick personally, but I know he's actually a huge fisherman, like huge fisherman. So you got to chat with him about that.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember him rolling through Pitt Meadows, Maple Ridge area there. Yes.
Yeah, I do as well. You and I are the exact same age, same grad year and everything, and I can still remember my school going out onto the street in Kamloops to watch Rick Hansen roll by and give him this rousing ovation. It was sensational stuff. I'm looking forward to chatting with him. I look forward to chatting with you next Thursday, my friend. Stay safe in Alberta now that you've done the same thing here in BC.
Yeah, we'll get some things taken care of here and probably make our way back out to the coast here at some point. But, yeah, you take care as well. And, yeah, okay, it was a good chat, Scotty. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks, Brendan. That is Brendan Morrison. Joins us every single Thursday. Gave you his thoughts on the return to play format for the National Hockey League, and for him coming off an Olympic break is probably the closest thing he can think of to try to get yourself up and running again. But this is, as we've talked about time and time again, unprecedented, as was the Man in Motion tour. Williams Lake in the spotlight today on the Best of BC. Rick Hansen is from there, and he's on this program next on Sportsnet 650.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Where were you when the Man in Motion tour rolled back through British Columbia? Do you remember being a part of it? Do you remember coming out to it? I know where I was. I was in Kamloops. I was in grade 7. Grade 6, actually, because it was in the spring of 1987. And I remember our class going out on the street, our entire school going out on the street and applauding and cheering as Rick Hansen was doing the final stretch right here through BC on the Man in Motion tour. Today we celebrate Williams Lake. It wasn't long after that that he came through Kamloops, that he went to his hometown of Williams Lake, British Columbia, and then eventually back to Vancouver and a packed BC place to welcome him back as he completed over 40,000 kilometers around the globe. Rick joins us here today. And Rick, thank you very much for doing this today as we celebrate your hometown on the Best of BC. And most importantly, we hope you and yours are safe and healthy at this time.
Hey, thanks a lot, Scott. I really appreciate it. It's an honor to be here chatting to you. And yeah, everybody's safe, and we're feeling very grateful during this challenging time for sure. And it seems like just yesterday, though, that we were wheeling through on the last leg of the tour. And I want to thank you for being there. You know, it was the thousands and thousands of people who took time and, you know, connected with the mission and the vision of the tour that kept me going. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was an impactful moment in so many people's lives, not the least of which was yours. Let's go back to where it all began. I know you're born in Port Alberni, but you grew up in Williams Lake for the most part, and you were a very fine athlete at a young age. What was your introduction to sports, and which sports did you play?
You know, it was a real privilege growing up in Williams Lake in the 70s. A young kid who had all kinds of athletic goals and dreams. My dad introduced me to softball. That was his real passion when I was a real youngster. And it was really then getting into basketball and volleyball and track and field, badminton, tennis, lots of different sports that really energized me as an athlete. And by the time I got to Williams Lake, I ran into two amazing coaches that just really drew me right into the two sports of volleyball and basketball, Bob Redford and Jack Berger. They were my teachers, my phys ed teacher and my business teacher. And also then they were the coaches and friends and mentors. So I felt pretty blessed to be in Williams Lake at that time.
Which were you planning on pursuing to the highest level? Which was the one that, or maybe it was both at that time, Rick, that really had your attention and drove your passion?
You know, the one that I was really graduating into, I thought it would have been basketball, but volleyball really, really picked up for me. And again, Bob Redford, my coach, he really inspired me. He got me involved in a lot of extra development. Each of them spent their time, you know, helping us, you know, off hours. And I was introduced to some amazing athletes and really was inspired by the game. I wasn't exactly super tall for the game. I was, you know, projecting to be about 6'1", 6'2". And yet I still just, I just loved it, every part of it. I couldn't wait. As a matter of fact, it was the summer of 73 that I was identified to try out for the provincial team, you know, for our upcoming Canada Summer Games. And it was just before that that I ended up coming back from a fishing trip and had my accident.
And I want to get to that in just one moment. But before we do, your hometown in general, Williams Lake, I think people know of, they don't necessarily know a lot about. What was the sporting culture like in Williams Lake at that time?
You know, because Williams Lake is more into the interior, you know, it had a tremendous diverse culture, you know, people from different walks of life, and everything from ranching to logging to mining, and different cultures and indigenous community as well. And so it was really sport that brought us all together. And you know, when you're in a smaller community, you know, if you love the outdoors like I do, it was like a paradise. But sport was the place that you could do 365 days of the year. And, you know, it was really energized. Hockey was a big deal, of course. And then, of course, then we became very well known for volleyball. And it actually became a hub for provincial volleyball development over the years.
As we've done our Best of BC series, we've had a lot of athletes from small towns around the province come on and say, unless you're from your small town, you might not quite understand, because while things are competitive, it's also extremely supportive and tight-knit, and people try to lift each other up. Did you find that the same thing in Williams Lake?
Oh, there's no doubt about it in so many ways. I mean, we were, you know, tight-knit, obviously smaller school, you know, everybody knew everybody, teachers knew everyone. You know, Jack Berger, my teacher, you know, and coach there in basketball, as an example, he would really literally just invite us over to his place, hang out. He was, you know, about 10 years older than us, so he was pretty young as well. And I think that more personal connection really actually made such a huge difference. And then you have the business community and the service community all providing support for, you know, the athletic ability, because when you're in a small town, you also have to travel more, and somebody needed to step up to help with the budget and to be able to support the, you know, the teachers and coaches on their extra time.
It's a really good point. Rick Hansen joins us this morning. We celebrate his hometown of Williams Lake on the Best of BC. You mentioned the accident you had at the age of 15 years old that would forever change your life. Rick, very few people can put themselves in your circumstance. How did you get through that mentally?
Well, you know, I think I had to rely on a lot of my athletic skills. You know, growing up in a sport culture, you know, first thing is, you know, you really learn how to bear down. And for me, it was also about setting some basic goals, you know, not really being able to understand the enormity of what had happened to me, because I'd had some minor injuries before, but they always got better. This was going to be a massive mystery for me, because I was told it would never get better. And that was a complete shock. I had to reframe, think about what possibilities still existed and what I could do in the things that I still loved. But I really relied on my family. I relied on, again, both my coaches. They spent time traveling all the way down from Williams Lake to the hospital that I stayed at for 4 months during that summer of 73. Spent my 16th birthday in the hospital, and they provided that moral support. Some of my teammates came in to see me and really helped get me through those really, really difficult times. And then, of course, came the ultimate challenge, which is going back home, not being able to use my legs, being in the town, in my home, in my school that was very inaccessible, and not having any knowledge about anyone else who had had a disability and what life would be like.
So there's the part of that you're a teenager and you probably, I think like most of us, feel you're invincible and you'll always overcome. And that is a common theme in athletics as well. How long did it take for the reality of your injury, the acceptance of that, to set in?
It took quite a while. You know, obviously it was a slow, there was no internet, and you know, information came by word of mouth and mostly by mentors and role models. So I had to be connected to people who inspired me. who showed that they had been there before. I had a mentor named Stan Strong, who showed up from the Canadian Paraplegic Association. He was a peer counselor, and he actually had heard that I used to play basketball, and he was also the volunteer team manager of a legendary wheelchair basketball team named the Vancouver Cable Cars. And they had some outstanding athletes, and he was the glue, Stan, as the manager, and he tried to recruit me. But my association with him gave me this incredible sense of inspiration, because even though he'd been injured since the 30s, and you know, he had it way worse off than I did, he had this incredible resilience and attitude, and he just didn't give it up. And he taught me that you can still control that space between what's happened to you and what you do with it, and it's your perspective. And he helped fill in the blanks to let me know that I could still be an athlete. And of course, he recruited me into the wheelchair basketball team, and sport again became a very powerful vehicle for me to regain my self-esteem, my dignity, and recognize that I was still whole as a human being, and I could still pursue goals and dreams. I just had to adapt.
As you mentioned, you go into wheelchair basketball. I know you played wheelchair volleyball as well. You went on to race as a wheelchair athlete, as a Paralympian as well. How did that sports circle expand from that initial meeting with Stan Strong and that recruitment into what it eventually became?
Well, you know, being able to show up in that first practice, kind of actually, to be honest, because of my view of sport was so, sport for athletes with disability was so minimized at that time, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't respect it that much. And then I came into the gym, and these incredible athletes like Eugene Reimer, who was Canada's Outstanding Male Athlete of the Year in 72, along with Karen Magnuson, who was the female athlete. And this guy, Peter Calistro, all-world champion, all-star, they just wheeled circles around me, and they were like athletic gods. And then I realized, oh, my gosh, this isn't some recreational activity. These guys are world-class, and I want to be just like them. And I put all of my energy back into sport. That was a huge revelation for me. It re-energized everything about me as an athlete, and just got me on the track and surrounded me with some amazing friends, great role models, incredible champions. And then eventually I was tasked by Stan to recruit, and I ended up bringing a guy who just lost his leg to cancer back into sport again too, and his name was Terry Fox.
And I want to get to that friendship in a minute, because it's so powerful and so impactful, and you're both our Canadian icons. I do want to talk about your goal setting at that point. Athletics is so much of that. And as you made your way into wheelchair basketball and wheelchair volleyball and started racing, what goals were you setting for yourself at that point, Rick?
You know, at first it was just get back into the game again and try to find my love and passion, and then see where it went, you know, little baby steps, just, you know, improving my sport. And then eventually I realized that I could perhaps, you know, continue to transfer those skills as an able-bodied athlete into one as a Paralympian. And maybe I could make my provincial team and work my butt off and did that and went to the nationals. And that was an incredible experience for me. And it, again, gave me a much broader view of possibilities and spurred me on and then eventually to make the national team, going to Stoke Mandeville and in the you know, Paralympic Games, and being able to compete for my country, travel the world, and then eventually you know, you go as far as you can in various sports, but sometimes you have to follow your passion and you know, be able to recognize that it's more than just getting engaged. It's really wanting to have no regrets. And you can believe that anything's possible, but not everything. And if you're too diffuse in sport, you know, it's going to be hard for you to really bring out your best. You need to focus. And so I decided through my entire experience there in volleyball and basketball, I'd really been doing a lot of external training on the track and getting stronger and faster and again, then enrolling in competitions. And eventually it just sucked me right up and into it. And I decided that that was it. I was going to give everything to my track and marathon competitions. And eventually that's what propelled me to break through and to go to the highest possible level that I could.
In conversation with Rick Hansen this morning on the Best of BC Williams Lake edition, you mentioned Terry Fox, and you're tasked with recruiting him, trying to get him involved in various Paralympic sports. What was that first meeting like, and how did that friendship blossom?
You know, I was having dinner with some friends, and they told me about this guy who went to SFU, and he played basketball, and he was struggling after having lost his leg. So I called him up and introduced myself and said, do you want to come to our first practice? And, you know, this coming week on a Monday evening, and he did. He hopped into the gym on one leg. I didn't know it at the time. He was still having chemotherapy. It was pretty weak from that transition. We brought an old chair out, and this guy, you know, he was pretty pathetic when you first saw him wheeling, but he had some pretty good basic skills, and he was super, super focused and determined, and obviously, you know, you could tell that eventually when he regained his strength and adapted to the chair, he was going to be a really good athlete, and he really was. He was one of our best players on the team. He was a spark plug in an engine, you know, to help organize, along with myself and others, practices. We'd go and train and wheel up Gilardi Way, up from, you know, the Lougheed Highway all the way up to the SFU Hill on Burnaby Mountain, do weights and then shoot hoops and practice, and then, you know, coast all the way back down to our cars in the rain and ultimately drive home and get ready to study, because we were both in university at the time. He was in human kinetics and I was in physical education at UBC. So, you know, we became great friends and we traveled together. We roomed together. He sure inspired me. I know that. And I know he was inspired by the Cable Cars team and by Stan Strong and the culture. And ultimately, as you know, everybody knows that Terry decided to pay it forward and try to run across the country to raise money for cancer and ultimately cure cancer. So that was a huge period of time. And it's so interesting. Our all-world, all-star champion, Peter Calistro, just got inducted into the BC Basketball Hall of Fame. And we were all there to, you know, applaud him and his incredible talent. And he made a joke and he said, you know, there's, you know, in this team, he said, I finally have something over my all my other teammates. There's three of these other teammates who have schools named after them, and he said, well, I'm finally in a club that they never made. So it was pretty impressive to see that happen.
That's great. Back to Terry Fox for a second. Did you know, or is it fair to say that you two were cut from the same cloth mentally, and that was part of that initial connection?
I think there's no question. We were both nurtured with a family that was supportive, and ultimately sport was our core. We were driven, always on adventures, and ultimately trying to go as far as you could. And we just had a lot of shared values and hung out together. And he was a great guy. I really admired Terry. He was, you know, again, he was honest, hardworking. He had a funny, dry sense of humor. And when we would do, you know, one year I was actually identified as an assistant player coach. And so every once in a while I got to run the practices, and I would, I knew that Terry, although he was really great, he didn't like to wheel backwards very, very much. And it really, he struggled. And so I did a few extra backward drills one day, and he looked over at me and he was pretty pissed.
So shortly after he begins the Marathon of Hope in 1980, you're off to the Paralympic Games. You come back with a gold, a silver, and a bronze. But I imagine prior to that, you two had discussed the possibility of the Marathon at Hope. What did you think in those days when he dreamed it up, Rick?
You know, Terry had been inspired by an amputee in the States who did a marathon. And I think in his training beyond wheeling, you know, he was trying to get proficient with his artificial leg, and he started extending his training on the track, kind of like I did on the in the wheelchair, and he then extended it further. And then one day we were actually driving back from a North American wheelchair basketball tournament, and I was in my little green Honda coming back from Seattle in the pouring rain, and it was dark, and we're, you know, pretty late, and we were chatting about everything. Then he got silent, and all of a sudden he kind of cleared his throat and he said, hey, what do you think about me running across Canada for cancer research? And I just looked over and I said, you know what, it would be outstanding. I said, you know, there's no question you could do it. And I said, the most important thing is make sure you have the support you need, because you don't want to go all that way to not make a difference. So, yeah, we were cheering for him and, of course, expected him to complete his journey. And we're all shocked that day when we heard the news that he was forced to abandon his journey at Thunder Bay.
I imagine a very difficult day, as it was for a lot of Canada. Rick Hansen joining us here this morning as we celebrate Williams Lake on the Best of BC. It was years later that you would embark on the Man in Motion tour. What was the genesis of that, Rick, and how did it all come together?
Well, I think like Kerry and so many other athletes, you know, you recognize that you're not there because of your own excellence and talent. You're there on the backs of your family and community supporters, coaches, sponsors, and you're always nurtured to try to pay it forward in the ways that you can. And you also, for me, it was actually learning to pick the things that called to you, learning about battling my own attitude about my disability and realize that I still had ability, learning about the external attitudes about me and many of my other colleagues, you know, who really had to struggle against that stereotype and the cliches and, you know, that sort of prejudice, and then the physical barriers that were out there everywhere, you know, stairs and just people just not really understanding. And, you know, you travel the world and it wasn't just in Canada, it was everywhere. And therefore, rather than complain about it, I just thought, well, hey, I'd really become excellent at marathoning and maybe I could combine my athletic talents to make a difference and change attitudes and help people remove barriers and maybe create a movement around the world. And that's when the Man in Motion World Tour really, really took form. And I really achieved, I think, most of my athletic goals at that time as a Paralympic champion and world champion and had a tremendous run. And I thought, well, you know, at this point I can take some time out, volunteer this time, and then maybe pick it up on the back end again.
Everybody who does something incredible goes through those moments where you ask yourself, can I really do this? Am I going to be able to move on? When did that first mental obstacle present itself for you?
Oh, man, it was really when I was just transitioning. 84 was the historic moment where, you know, wheelchair athletes were included in the 800 and 1500 exhibition race in Los Angeles at the Olympics and also our Paralympic championships. And I crashed my wheelchair training for a marathon and dislocated my shoulder, and the doctor had written me off. And by that time, the dream of wheeling around the world had been real, and I'd been planning and starting to prepare. And really, it wasn't until I was assigned to a physiotherapist, and her name was Amanda, and she really treated my shoulder, got me back in time to go to the Olympic and Paralympic Games. And of course my coach Tim Frick helped me get there as well, and the two of them really put me in a position to still be in the hunt for the dream of wheeling around the world. But that shoulder was always lingering, and just trying to get the support was a massive challenge. There was so much skepticism, doubt, and of course legitimate obstacles to overcome. And so I got to this place where I literally had to fight against even an internal mutiny of our organizing team, who also started to doubt that it was possible. And I had to put my foot down and say, look, regardless of being perfectly organized, we have to start. And it's going to be on March the 21st of 85. And, you know, if you can't be there, I respect you. But those of you who can, I'd appreciate it, because I think we're just going to have to take it one day at a time and find a way to make it happen.
Where in your journey around the world did you encounter your most difficult physical challenge?
You know, I was injured after the first few days and about ready, not too far down the road through Washington, Oregon, to climb the Siskiyou Mountain summit. And I didn't know if tendonitis, the wrists and the elbows from such a difficult terrain and weather, and wheeling 113 kilometers a day, almost three marathons, had taken its toll already. And I was just dejected. So Amanda came down and she, you know, really intensely addressed the physical demands so that I could actually summit. And I broke through the end of that day and looked up and saw California on the horizon and knew that first battle had been ultimately accomplished. And I was truly not going to wilt at the first sign of major adversity. So that was the biggest physical challenge, and then the biggest psychological challenge was having been Boyd coming back from China, being not only on the Great Wall, but having millions of people line the streets and coming back to the States up the Eastern Seaboard. It had been really quiet and not a lot of support because we just couldn't break through. And ultimately, I just decided I was going to quit because I had lost faith that maybe Canadians wouldn't respond either. And what was the point? And Amanda talked me off that limb and back into just believing that good things will happen, no regrets, one day at a time. And Providence kicked in, and she was right. You know, Canadians did respond, and I was almost going to bail at that moment. And I was so grateful that she challenged and encouraged and then inspired me to hang in there.
You talked about earlier in this interview, Rick, how when you got back to Canada, how buoyed you were by the crowds and the support from your home and native land. Was it almost overwhelming?
Yeah, it truly was. Coming back again, still not knowing and having the doubt and skepticism and concern coming up the States, I just didn't know. And in St. John's, it was unbelievable. Just happened to be my 29th birthday, and when I was in St. John's and crowd was out, and everywhere we went, small towns, bigger communities, right through the Atlantic provinces, through Quebec, into Ontario, was phenomenal. I'll never forget being on Parliament Hill in Ottawa, and Prime Minister Mulroney dropped $1 million check on behalf of Canadians into the Kinsmen fundraising bucket. And it was hugely inspiring. And then I found out later that day that someone had lost the check and they were scrambling. And I guess somebody had actually taken it and kept it at home because they didn't want to lose it. And they eventually sighed their big sigh of relief. And maybe I had a good chuckle about that. We almost lost the $1 million check. But that kind of response, though, was so powerful as we went through the Lakehead and ultimately the prairies in the middle of winter.
So obviously you're known for the Man in Motion Tour, and we have come so far in our understanding, and we've made so many strides as a result of that and the work you've put in and many others have put in years later. As you look back on it all, what are you most proud of, Rick?
You know, I think that Canada has come a long way, and so has the world, a long way on their sense of attitudes about disability. I think people recognize more and more that it's not a death sentence or being trapped and losing your human rights and dignity. That Canada's constitution talks about people with disabilities as being equal, and I think Canadians and people around the world largely believe that that's true, and then therefore we should build this young country and this world in a way where unnatural barriers, attitudinal or physical barriers, shouldn't be there. We should be able to be included and engaged and contribute. So therefore, yeah, that's come so far, and we still have a long way to go. There's still a lot of big gaps there, but I'm really proud of so many champions, families, communities, governments, and organizations that are slowly chipping things away and knocking barriers down and opening up new opportunities that I couldn't have imagined when I was a kid, finishing my high school at Kalamusa in Williams Lake.
Well, there's a lot of people that couldn't have imagined it. You have been that symbol, and you have been that proof that, yes, it is possible, and dream big because it can be accomplished. We've seen you do so many things, including bungee jumping, which I watched a few years ago, which was incredible. That was fantastic. I promised I would not let you go because Brendan Morrison comes on this show every single week, and he said, Rick is a big fisherman. I can't have you finish that interview without asking him about his passion for fishing, so I will do that now.
Well, fishing started the whole thing, right? It's been part of my journey, and it became, an adventure that caused my accident that, really opened up and unfolded my destiny, and I've continued to do it. I love fishing, born and raised in D.C., and ultimately, I'm very involved also in salmon and sturgeon conservation. Fraser River sturgeon, banks of Williams Lake, Abbotsford and Richmond, where I currently live, and salmon on the West Coast and in rivers everywhere. If we can protect them and ensure they're sustainable for the future, we keep a healthy province and keep jobs going and tourism and And ultimately, we can all, make a difference. When we take something, we can give at least the same amount or more back.
Very well said, and I'm not surprised by that. Rick, thank you so much for your time today. As you know, we're living at a time where we need a lot of hope, and you've provided so much for so many people over the years. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story once again with us here.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Well, we'll just keep it moving forward, and a huge tribute to Williams Lake, my hometown, and all the folks who've made a difference and helped me get to this point. Never forget it. Always be there. And, let's just keep pounding some of those barriers down and get to the original dream.
No question. Thank you, Rick.
All the best.
That is Rick Hansen in the incredible story and some of the details along the way that you may not have known, and some of those people who inspired him and how he was propelled along the way as he continued to be that symbol for so many people and does to this day around the world. Outstanding interview, and we've got another one on tap as well. Olympic medal winner coming up next. Kayla Molesky of our Women's National Sevens team joins us next as we celebrate Williams Lake on the Best of BC.
More of the Scott Rintoul Show on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Williams Lake in the spotlight today, highlighting that small town in BC's interior as part of our Best of BC platform that we've been rolling out over the last number of weeks. Thanks for joining us here today as we wrap up the Scott Rintoul Show. And our pleasure to welcome a member of our National Women's Rugby Sevens team and someone who hails from Williams Lake, Kayla Molesky, joins us here this morning. Kayla, I'm not sure where we find you around the province here today, but we hope wherever you are, you are safe and healthy.
I am in Victoria, BC, actually. So I am very healthy. I'm very happy. And I'm just training away towards, the 2021 Olympics for Tokyo. So keeping a positive outlook and just trying to enjoy the sunshine.
I know you're trying to upgrade the medal. You're very proud of it from what you got in Rio, but I know you want a couple levels higher next time around. We'll get to that in just one second, but it all began back in Williams Lake, which is what we're profiling today, and the great athletes and sports that have come out of that community. What was life like as a young athlete in Williams Lake, and what were you interested in?
Yeah, I mean, I was born and raised in Williams Lake. My parents were both born and raised there. My mom not born, but my brother as well. And I mean, it's just such a wonderful community. The sports in general, like for myself, I grew up playing baseball and hockey, and all the sports in between, of course, in school and everything like that. But yeah, baseball and hockey were my jam, and I loved it. I loved the sense of community and camaraderie within sports, and I always thrived in those environments and just being a team player. And I think Williams Lake really, really brings that out and brings the best of that out, especially for athletes and for people in the community, because whether that's mountain biking or nature walks or even just, playing chess, I feel like there's always something in Williams Lake that you can pick up and just take off with and really, really enjoy it. And I think, the sense of support that the community has given me, and I know many others, and I heard you just spoke to Rick Hansen, and I've met him a few times, the first time being in the Williams Lake Mall, Botanical Mall. And yeah, I was in awe with his accomplishments and kind of what he's done. And he's taken community to a new level. And it's really cool to see the people that are being, highlighted out of Williams Lake, and not just the people, but the town itself, because it really is a special place. And I started rugby when I was in grade 9. We actually moved from one place in Williams Lake to the other when I was in grade 7, and it just so happened that the rugby fields were in my backyard. So my dad and I would walk to the end of our property line and sit on this one rock that edged the line of our property and the rugby fields, and we'd actually watch them play. And whether it was practicing or playing, I just remember saying to my dad, I'm going to play this sport. Like, there's no doubt about it. I played every other sport, and rugby was one that I haven't yet honed in on. And when I saw it there, I was like, I'm playing this sport. There's no doubt about it. And my dad just looked at me and said, yeah, you will. And ever since then, I've just had this hunger and this drive and passion to get to the highest level. And before the Olympics, that was just playing on the National Women's Senior Team for sevens on the World Series stage, and that was to be the best player that I could possibly be. And when we found out that it was an Olympic sport and that it was going to be featured, and like my eyes just like beamed. I was like, you got to be kidding me. This is awesome. Like, I'm so excited that there is more to come with this sport that I love so much. And it was all thanks to just Williams Lake being there for me and supporting me, whether that was through fundraisers or I did a lot of bottle drives growing up, like a lot of the kids did, and all to just kind of drive that dream that I had of playing for Canada and playing on the highest world stage that I possibly could. So it's been a real dream to say that I live my dream job. Not very many people can, and I really am. I'm loving every minute of it. I mean, having a setback like COVID has been quite a challenge, I guess, like both mentally and physically. It just kind of flips your world upside down. But on the optimistic side of that is everyone's safe, and we're all doing our part to kind of flatten the curve and make sure everyone is okay. And I think it just shows good leadership that we're able to do that. And even with Williams Lake, my mom, she's an essential worker. She's a manager at the wholesale club, and I'm just so proud of what she's able to accomplish. And then Williams Lake supporting her every way that she can with making sure people are safe to get their groceries, you know, like that's a really big thing. So sorry, I'm rambling.
No, not at all. No, not at all. You touched on a lot of important things there. And the last note is a very important one. And I think a lot of people have been conscious of saluting our essential workers. And so I think that point should be underscored. Kayla Molesky joining us here as we celebrate her hometown, Williams Lake, BC, on the best of BC. It's one thing to be an athlete and to say, hey, I want to play that sport, but that doesn't propel you onto the national team all of a sudden. Who were some of those impactful and influential people as you made your way into this brand new sport?
Yeah, so my best friend's family, her dad coached us in high school, Todd Pritchard, as well as Mauro Calabrese. I mean, obviously my parents and my brother have been huge supporters of me and my grandparents and everyone, but those two people, Mauro Calabrese and Todd Pritchard, they really elevated my drive to be the best players that I could be in rugby and just in life. Like, there's so many life goals that you could take out of rugby and apply them to everyday life. And I think that's what I love so much about sport is, you know, I haven't gone to university and came out with a degree. I've done some schooling here and there, but I focused, my main goal was to play at the highest level, and that was to be an Olympian, obviously a gold medalist, but we came out with bronze at the Olympics and obviously looking to make that some gold hardware this next year. But those guys have really, they really sparked it in me to find that drive and that passion to just dig deep when the moments hurt the most, when I was on the field or in practice. And I think too, failure is a really big part of success, and without failure, we don't have those learning opportunities. We don't know what we can kind of make better and try to be able to achieve the next goal. And I really think over the years, it's been a struggle sometimes to cope with that failure of, man, I didn't make it, or, you know, why am I sitting on the bench, or what more do we need to do? Why do we lose to New Zealand, kind of thing? And I think the biggest thing is that we're just making ourselves better players every time we step out onto the field, and it's getting that much closer of a game every time. And that started from a young age of just being able to deal with those failures, is what most people call them, but we like to call them learning opportunities, because it's not, you're only failing if you're quitting in the end of it, but those opportunities are there for you to seize. And that's what we do every day. We live and train in Victoria, BC. We're a centralized group of about 22, 23 athletes, and we live and train every day. Obviously not right now. We're training on our own, but it's a full team effort in our accomplishments, and everyone has a huge role to play. And I really think that, we owe a lot to each other, because we sit there day in and day out grinding on the field. And that's just practice. Maybe that's in the weight room or running speed. And just trying to be the best, fittest, fastest, strongest athletes that we can be. But on top of that, mentally having our game solid. And that starts with, we always say it's a me before we mentality. You need to be the best you that you can be, so that when you bring your attributes to the team, that you're only elevating it and you're making it that much better. And we really do focus on that. And I think that's what sets our team apart from other teams, is we're able to cope with failure and have a good relationship with it and then turn it around so it creates a better opportunity for us for success. And I think that's what you guys will all be looking forward to seeing over this next year in our lead up to Tokyo.
No question. And you mentioned it, Kayla Molesky, in conversation with us as she joins us here to celebrate Williams Lake on the Best of BC. You talked about how excited you were to find out that Sevens was going to be an Olympic event, and then you helped excite this nation and how much people viewed the Sevens team and got behind that group that won a bronze medal down in Rio. What was it like to be part of not only a team that achieves that, but an Olympics that really, from Canada's perspective, was defined by the performance of our women?
I honestly am still to this day one of the proudest Canadians. Like, it's such a surreal experience to have said that, you know, we went to the Olympics, first time for women's rugby sevens. Like, it's such an honor to say that I was able to wear the maple leaf over my heart and play some incredible games with the girls that are my family, right? And to have my family actually in Rio, in the stands, watching each game as we, you know, successfully were able to take a podium finish was incredible. I mean, I have no words for that and that feeling, because it's so unique. It's such an accomplishment. I mean, I keep thinking about what we need to do for 2021. And, but it just starts with just taking each day as it comes and being the best person that we can be, an athlete, and just constantly grinding it out. And I mean, coming home to Williams Lake after the Olympics and like sharing my gold medal, or my gold medal, see, that's how much it means to me, my bronze medal with my community in Williams Lake was outstanding. It was so fantastic. I mean, they ended up having a parade for me. I remember one of the dealerships there deckled out this truck for us, and it said Olympic bronze medalist Kayla Molesky, and they were like, "Hey, we have a parade for you." The Williams Lake Rugby Club, the wrestlers, they decked out their bus. We have like this red bus that we travel on to and from tournaments for club rugby, but they decked it out. And like, I remember being in the back of the truck and we were turning the corner by the cop station, and I was like, oh my God, like, we're going by the cop station and I'm riding in the back of this truck. Yes, we were going a safe speed, but I just looked at one of the cops and said, "You're going to let me get away with this one, right?" And they're like, "This time, yeah, we'll let you get away with it this time." And yeah, like, there were so many people out there just saying how proud of us they were, and just being a small town girl, just living her dream and bringing something so special back to Williams Lake and being able to help put it on the map like so many others have, has been so incredible. I mean, yeah, I could list words for days, but it's really hard to describe it, to describe that feeling of honor and pride that I have for wearing the maple leaf and repping Williams Lake and my family and my friends. And it's been such an incredible journey, and I'm really looking forward to this next year.
Well, I can tell you this, having had this conversation with you, and I know our listeners will agree, it translates through this phone line. It's your enthusiasm and your pride for both your hometown and your country and your sport and everything you're doing is very genuine, and it makes it really easy for all of us to cheer for you as well. I wish you continued success. I hope the building toward what has been a postponed Olympic Games is fantastic for you. And once again, thanks for sharing your story, Kayla, and I hope you stay safe and healthy in these times.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. A shout out to all the essential workers. You guys are doing an amazing job. And also everyone just doing your part. Stay safe and stay true to that. And we'll all get back out there soon enough. But All the best, guys. Thank you so much for your support.
Well said. That is Kayla Molesky, part of our National Women's Sevens team, won a bronze medal in Rio, expecting to come back with even more when she heads to Tokyo. At least that's the plan for next summer. Good interview, fun hour. Rick Hansen joined us, and Kayla referenced him during the course of that conversation. She's such a fantastic story as well, picking up the sport at the age of 14. Less than 7 years later, she's debuting for Canada, going on to win that first ever bronze medal awarded at an Olympic Games in a sevens tournament format. Carey Price certainly bears some mention here. He's born in Anaheim Lake, BC, but grew up in Williams Lake and has been such an integral part of that community and a champion for young athletes and young hockey players there. Was good on Hockey 24. If you watched that last weekend like I did, that you saw the story of another young up-and-coming goaltender in Williams Lake. Looks like he's going to be a good one as well, 15 years old. He's become very inspirational in that community. If you haven't had a chance to watch Hockey 24, I would suggest you do. I found it to be a really great snapshot of where hockey is at across this country in various communities from coast to coast. Fun Thursday. We're going to have a great Friday in store for you as well. We're going to feature my hometown, Kamloops, BC, in the spotlight tomorrow. Mark Recchi is going to join us at that time. Huge shout out to Jamie Dodd. Lined up a great program. Really enjoyed that conversation in the last hour with Rick Hansen and certainly Kayla as well. We got a stellar program coming your way tomorrow. Greg Ballack was on the board today. He'll be there again tomorrow. Social Distance Central. It's coming up next. It's Bick Nizar. It's Brendan Batcher right here on your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.